Well, it was a rough week for those watching the Senate confirmation hearings of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, no matter whose side you were on. Today, on the Longview, our contributing analyst Neil Milner tackles what happens now that the focus is shifting to the midterm elections. Morning.
Hi.
So, what gives?
Well, what gives is a very broad question that involves a lot of contradictory stuff in terms of how it's going to affect the election. And right now, it's really in a state of flux. I want to look at a study that was really done a little bit before the Kavanaugh confirmation or before the hearings that suggests certain things that might happen in the election coming up in the midterms. But as far as what we know right now, there's a lot of contradictory evidence about whether this will help the Democrats or the Republicans. There's some evidence that Republican voters are narrowing the enthusiasm gap that it would help the Democrats. The thing is, we don't know how much that affects voting, and there's a lot of really sort of mixed up sort of stuff. People increasingly disapproved of Kavanaugh as a choice over time, even after the thing. People didn't like the way he was treated in the hearing. They kind of disapproved of the whole process. But at the same time, of all things, Mitch McConnell's approval rating has gone up. Now, it was pretty low to start with. So I guess the best thing you can say is that we really don't know, and there's a lot of spinning going on as each political party says it's going to help us, and we'll have to watch over time. Remember, there isn't much time before the election.
No, there isn't.
And so that's an important factor. And people in a polarized situation are pretty much locked in. Now, given that, we can look at this particular piece of research that's done on where the competitive districts are in the 2018 midterms, the competitive House of Representatives things. And if you go through that and you think about Kavanaugh, there are some interesting suggestions about where the battles are going to be and how it could work against Republicans. So let's look at that very quickly. The first thing is that this is a City Lab study, which is and based very much on data. And what they did was not just to look at urban versus rural versus suburban. They divided the country according to density. And it turns out that the key races are in the suburbs, but in that is the key most competitive races. But they're in certain kinds of suburbs, not the ones that are very rural, the ones that are sort of a mix of a little rural, a little bit of high density, and then your regular suburban things, and suburbs that are a little stronger than that. Now, it turns out that the Republicans in these areas hold in these areas that are competitive. These are the places, this is where the election's going to be decided in these districts because they're competitive. Most districts, most races are not competitive. Most House seats are safe. The Republicans have more of these competitive races. They hold the seats now. 40% of these seats that are competitive are Republican. Only one out of 90. So what, 1% are Democratic. So they don't talk about Kavanaugh here, but there are certain things in here about competitive districts that suggest something about the results of the Kavanaugh thing. So let's look very quickly at that. It turns out that these two kinds of suburban districts that are the most competitive tend to be a little bit wealthier, a little less white than the rural areas, and tend to have a higher number of college-educated people. All of those sorts of things lean in the direction of Democrats a little bit more. The Republican Party is essentially a white party with white males being in the lead. And the recent elections have shown that density determines things. That is, the lower the density of the area you live in, the more likely it is to be Republican. The higher the density that you live in, and it goes right down the map. So if you look at those competitive races that tend to be a little less white, but still pretty white, higher education, higher income, they were the ones that were a little more likely to leak their Republican support because they didn't like Trump. A little bit more, it varied. And women were particularly in that group, where women moved away. Most Republican women still voted for Trump, but if you look at the polls over time, higher educated folks in the suburbs and in other places, and women were more anti-Trump. So you then look at the Kavanaugh situation. If these people are more likely to leak and they haven't made up their mind yet, particularly women, was this enough to push more women into the Democratic camp as far as voting is concerned? Now, remember, if it's a close race, it doesn't take very much to change the outcome. Most people don't change their minds about what parties they voted for. But in a close election, in a competitive election, that may be enough to move it. So that suggests, if you don't know anything else, that in these most competitive races, it may lean now a little bit more to the advantage of the Democrats.
But what do you think is going to happen? I mean, we saw the president at a campaign rally the other day, and he basically said, yeah, the folks that were against Kavanaugh are evil.
Well, he can say, I mean, look, most of the time the president speaks, he's speaking to his base. Through all kinds of weird situations here, not so weird. One is the Republicans wanted Kavanaugh all the way along the line because he's a firm conservative. There's a brief unification between standard conservatives and Trump. Doesn't happen very often. And it happened on this. What the Republicans are arguing, and you have to Trump is not the best political analyst when he's on the stump. He's got instincts, but not in the stump. What you're maybe saying is that that there are enough people, Republicans, who were offended by the process that they lean. But that may be the case. And that they become more enthusiastic here. The Republicans keep talking about more enthusiasm. But the real question is not how enthusiastic they are, it's whether they'll vote or not. Are these people who are more motivated, would they have been likely to vote anyway? And they would probably have been likely to vote Republican anyway. So the campaign is certainly nasty. It's certainly totally depressing about what's happened now. And there may be long-term ramifications of this. But right now, I don't think you're going to find big changes as a result of this. But again, if you look at the competitive races, all it may take is small changes. And right now, most of the analysts think that the Democrats have, one of the best analysts of this does a lot of interesting data stuff. It's about a 77% probability that the Democrats will carry the House. Now, remember, 77% means that in any situation, in 100 times you have this election, 22 times or 23 times it would work the other way. We should learn that from the Trump probabilities. But that's what it looks like right now.
Well, what about the thought that, as it gets closer to the election, that if something else happens, that when you're in the voting booth, emotion will take over and
emotion doesn't take over very much in the voting booth. I think that, again, whatever anybody says about what could happen could play a role if the election is close enough. In a theoretical election, if all it takes is one vote to turn something around, and that one voter happens not to like the hairdo of the opposing candidate, that could make enough of a decision. But most people have a pretty firm idea about who they're going to vote for. This is a very kind of visible activity that we see, this event with Kavanaugh. But it's not going to change the overwhelming majority of people's minds about who they vote for. But again, in competitive districts, it doesn't have to change too many people's minds of who they're going to vote for.
Right. And then we'll just start to see just nastier campaigns as we get closer.
By the way, I guess I should remind everybody that neither of the Hawaii congressional districts is even remotely close to being competitive. These are safe Democratic districts.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens.
Sure.
That was HPR's political analyst Neil Milner with the long view of the midterm elections.
I'm Marco Werman here at the World's Newsroom. The U.S. Navy flew its planes away from the Florida Panhandle earlier this week, and they've tied down just about everything else. But whether it's Michael or Florence or a storm by any other name, America's shoreline defenses get battered because climate change makes hurricanes more ferocious. We're looking at that and many other stories today on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In 1883, the Hawaiian Humane Society was established as an organization dedicated to preventing cruelty to animals, and this goal has remained with the society. Its roots can be traced back to Helen Kinau Wilder, who was the first to be given police authority to enforce animal cruelty laws in Hawaii. Appointed as a special constable by the Marshal of the Republic of Hawaii, Wilder would venture out on horseback to do many of the same tasks that are done today by Humane Society officers in animal rescue trucks. Now, HHS has also serves as an educational organization, an animal shelter, and a provider of a wide range of services and community outreach programs. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us what year the Hawaiian Humane Society moved to its present location on Wailai Avenue and South King Street in Honolulu? Call 941-3689 or toll free at 1-877-941-3689 if you think you know it. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, with international service to Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and the South Pacific. HawaiianAirlines.com.
October happens to be Mental Health Awareness Month. A number of groups are holding events to tackle the stigma of mental illness. How do you get over mental health hang-ups when it can prevent you from getting help? Bashir is an art teacher at Kamehameha School. Her work will be featured at an upcoming event sponsored by the Hawaii chapter of Mental Health America. We sat down to explore art as therapy and as a way to get young people to open up and get help if they need it.
Really, the goal is to destigmatize kind of some of the preconceived notions that we have around some of those disorders or those differences.
A lot of folks feel ashamed and they don't want to talk about it, and so they don't get treatment.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think there is, especially like I'm a high school teacher, and I really worry about that because that kind of can cascade into a whole other bunch of problems, and really your mental health is probably the most important thing. So the goal is to really say, hey, we're all different. It's not just right or wrong, and it's not this diagnosis versus that diagnosis. Like, it's a whole spectrum. So the goal is to really talk about it and to make it more normalized so people can seek treatment, they can start that dialogue.
And so how do you reach the kids? How do you reach them when, you know, with that message?
Well, for me personally, like, I'm not a health teacher, I'm an art teacher, so we can get a little more creative with it. We can talk about our narratives and our personal stories, and we can kind of create a safe space for the kids. And one way that I can kind of open that door is I can talk a lot about my own work, which has a lot to do with mental health and my own mental health. And that kind of puts it in perspective. It's like, oh, wait a minute, here's this totally functional, pretty normal adult, you know? Well, if she's got this going on, like, that maybe that's not so bad. Maybe it's not so, you know, different after all. So at my last school, we try to give back a lot, and I'm trying to bring this to my new school because I just got this job at Kamehameha. And in my last school, we went out into the community and we did a mural for Child and Family Service at a private shelter for them, and that really brightened up the hallway, and it made them feel safe and welcome. And so it's that kind of, also, we're talking about you as a student and your identity, but then also kind of paying it forward. Like, okay, you get to know you. How can then you take this knowledge and this ability and then brighten up somebody else's life? So it really ends up being a ripple effect.
I mean, I've been to a shelter, and I know there was one was for family with young children, mm-hmm. and it was kind of cool because the kids got to actually put their fingerprints.
Oh, yeah,
know,
that's the one I'm talking about. Oh. Yeah, they got to actually be the children who worked there or who lived there. They actually got to be a part of it, so that was really exciting.
Yeah, it was a neat event, mm-hmm. a very neat event. And so then with Kamehameha, what's the plan? How else are we moving this forward?
Well, I'd like to keep that moving forward. So before I got involved with Mental Health Hawaii, I actually was a recipient of some FEAST funding, which is a community event where artists propose and they say, I want to do this event. They, you know, the community votes and they decide who can kind of use this funding. And actually I have funding that I'm going to use for further murals with hopefully Child and Family Service, if not other kind of give back type community organizations.
Other nonprofits.
Yeah, other nonprofits. So I'm hoping that maybe not this semester, but next semester, that can be kind of an ongoing thing.
If folks go to this event over at Cafe Julia, what will they see?
So what we created was, I have a portfolio of work, some old work that fits this theme, and then some new work. One that's a little bit more, I hesitate to say stereotypical, but it's a little bit darker, which I think people kind of associate mental illness and artists with this dark place. And to kind of counteract that, I created a very bright and colorful piece. So the audience will be able to experience both sides of that. So it's kind of a self-portrait.
With the kids that you work with, what have you seen when you start working with the paints or whatever medium that you happen to be working with? I mean, take us through the process, maybe what you've experienced with the children.
Well, they slowly reveal, you know, and it all depends on how they feel, and we try to make them feel as safe as possible, and none of the assignments ever require them to go beyond what they feel comfortable sharing about, because it's still a pretty volatile age. But, you know, one thing I've noticed is they'll start talking about the things that are important to them and people who do make them feel safe. So if they have a symbolic or surrealist piece and they have an option to put places or people or things in there, and suddenly we'll start, oh, you know, kind of tell us about that. We'll talk about it in the critique. Oh, this place was really important because it's the bench that I sat on with my tutu, and she would talk to me, and that's the person I shared with most, and now she's passed. And so that's, you know, the getting into these stories and saying, like, oh, do you have anybody to talk to now? And then kind of starting that dialogue, okay, who can we connect you to, and who can we kind of, you know, get you in a place where you feel as safe as you did, you know, potentially that you did with your grandmother.
So it's really, it's art therapy is what it is.
Yes, you know, I think it's great therapy, honestly, yeah. I was really lucky. I mean, I think when I was younger, I had this amazing middle school art teacher who was just very open to trying new things, and she was so very encouraging. And that to me just, I mean, she'd say stuff to me like, oh, when you have your first art show. And, you know, as a teenager, I'm like, oh, I don't think so. You know, maybe, maybe not. And she's like, no, when you have your first art show, I want to be invited. And she was very positive and kind. And, you know, we were weird back then. And she was totally open to it. So I hope that I can create that same kind of environment. Just like, hey, whoever you are, that's okay with me.
So she kind of nurtured that artistic talent and kind of gave you that confidence.
Oh, absolutely. And it was just beyond the actual technique. She just made me feel like less of an outcast. You know, you feel kind of, you know, you're in and alone in and of yourself at that age. And she just made me feel like, oh, no, you're totally fine. Like, you as you is great. And that really struck a chord with me. And, of course, I didn't recognize it at the time. But now I realize, like, oh, that applies to all these kids. You, as you are, is exactly what you need to be. I definitely have some students who recently they've kind of graduated and gone on and said, like, oh, man, I really think I want to get into graphic design, or I really think I want to get into journalism because they won't have stories to tell and things that they want to say. And to me, like, I don't need you to be a painter. I don't need you to be Picasso, but if you feel that you have a voice, if you feel that you've found a medium in which you can communicate, that's all I can hope for. And the fact that I have students already who are going to college looking for ways to speak up, basically, especially in this climate, it's just really inspiring.
And so then what else can folks expect to see at the event coming up?
I think it's going to be a really important gathering of people for not only talking about art, but talking about like, how can we talk about this? How can we reach students' lives? How can we? And it's not just young people. I feel like young people are becoming more and more comfortable with this kind of discussion. But like, people my age, you know, they still kind of hesitate to say, you know, oh, I struggle with this, or, you know, or I have this, but I'm very fully functional. It's still a very challenging dialogue. So I hope it's this kind of conversation is going to create that ripple effect, that when people continue to talk about the event, they continue to talk about Mental Health Hawaii, people say, oh, I know somebody like that, or, oh, maybe I should tell so-and-so about that, or, oh, maybe I should get myself involved. So it kind of just keeps the ripples going, you know, slowly but surely outward.
Right, but get them to open up, you
Absolutely.
Know, whether it's I'm sad,
mm-hmm.
you know, or I'm mad, or I just feel like I'm all wound up.
Yeah, or I don't even know what my emotion is. You know, it's okay to not know or have a name for how you're feeling, you know. You might, and some, I think some people even doubt the severity of what they have. And it's like, you know, if you feel that you need to discuss, like, you absolutely should, without shame, without feeling, you should feel proud that you have the courage to be able to say, I need help, or I need to just even speak on something. So that's really my goal, is to make a safe space, or at least, you know, open that door so people feel that kind of ability to say something if they need to.
Right, and get help.
Absolutely.
That was Ba Shure, an art teacher at Kamehameha Schools. Her work will be on exhibit at Cafe Julia at the YWCA in Honolulu. It's an event put on by Mental Health America, set for October 18th. For links, go to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we talk to the organizers of the Cyber Success Program, which introduces students to IT fundamentals. The aim of the program is to introduce youth in economically disadvantaged areas on Oahu to the opportunities in IT and cybersecurity. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
The sign of the times. When is the IBM building no longer the IBM building? Well, that's the subject of our reality check with partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Stuart Yurton has a story about this. Very curious story. Stuart, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Catherine. Yes, it is curious. And your question is one thing that we're not sure of, if it's going to continue to be called the IBM building. This is the landmark building there on Alamoana Boulevard.
Yes, very distinctive architecture. I love it.
Yes, it is. It's designed by Vladimir Osipov, the famous architect, and it has this really distinctive facade built for IBM and designed to look like one of those old-fashioned IBM punch cards, computer cards.
Yeah, I've had friends who work with IBM and were in that building. And so to think that they have to move out, tell us about that.
Well, so the building is owned by Howard Hughes Corporation, which is the developer for the whole Ward Village master planned area. They're developing all these really striking luxury condo towers down there and really refurbishing or renovating the place, redeveloping that whole area. They want to use the building to consolidate some of their workers who are located off-site, so bring everybody to the building. And they also are using spaces in the building to do model condo units so they can show people what the condos will look like, people who want to buy the condos.
Right, yeah, I know somebody that actually had work constructing, I think, some of those models in that office building. But it is just so interesting to think that maybe IBM won't be there anymore, and we don't know where they're going to go.
No, we don't. They wouldn't talk to us for the story. We were able to confirm with Howard Hughes that the lease is up, and the IBM's lease is up at the end of the year, and Howard Hughes will be taking over that space on the fourth floor of the building, but we don't know where IBM is going to go.
Yeah, I do know of other folks that were in that building and have had to find, you know, other locations, other offices elsewhere in Honolulu. I think one person I know moved to Evil A.
Interesting. Yeah, one of the people we talked to was saying that it is hard to find commercial like office space there in Kaka'ako now. You know, we have all of these new retail spaces and restaurants and everything else, and it's really become this sort of lively hub for people. But it sounds like office space is kind of hard to find.
Yeah, so it's kind of curious with all the development. You know, I know they're going to create more retail residential space, but yeah, you kind of wonder what the rents are going to be like in that area for businesses who are dislocated and have to relocate somewhere.
Right. That and again, we can look at that. The key to this, really though, is that, you know, when we talk to Howard Hughes, they say this is a function of our success. You know, we have been growing so much, we've increased the number of employees we have many times. To expect it to have over 100 employees down there now, so they want a place to house everybody and where they can keep everybody in the same place.
Yeah, that is pretty curious. But you know, I know for me, I still refer to Macy's sometimes as Liberty House and Don Quixote as Dae. So I don't know. Sure. I might be prone to just calling the IBM building the IBM building, even though they're not there anymore.
Right. Well, that is a question. Could it still be named the IBM building? I don't know. I guess that's a possibility. You know, as we said in the story, you know, the Pan Am building is still called the Pan
Yes.
Am building. But Pan Am's out of business, so that's a little different. But could it still be called the IBM building? I really don't know. Like I said, IBM wouldn't talk to us, and Howard Hughes couldn't really comment on that.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much. A really interesting story. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you.
That was our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
What's in a name?
Biggie. B-I-G-G-Y. Biggie with the Y, not the I-E.
Biggie with the Y. Veteran, prisoner, expert in the law.
And this is my little domain right here. My war room.
A lifer takes on a prosecutor on the next reveal.
This evening at 7.
We had a lot of feedback following our recent show on recycling. We're sharing a couple of voices with you, starting with John in Kailua.
I've been making an effort to change behavior through education regarding office chairs. So just teaching people how to reupholster their own office chair. There are many that are on the side of the road contributing to bulky pickup. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Brendan. I'm calling from Kaimuki. Regarding consumer sorting of the blue bin recyclable material. Now, I realize that the instructions are printed directly on the receptacle, so it shouldn't be that difficult, but it's just an astonishing level of mistaken items. Just in my neighborhood, I walk my dogs around the neighborhood, and on recycling day when the blue bins are out, they're stuffed with everything from polystyrene to old garden hoses and chairs, and it seems to me that there really needs to be some sort of public service outreach that very simply inform people that, there are only certain items and materials that can be recycled. I think this would be extremely helpful. This must be incredibly expensive for the folks who have to then deal with these massive amounts of material that are not recyclable.
Thanks for the feedback. You know, this issue touched a nerve. We're considering a second show on recyclables. But email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. First Friday. Hard to believe that the city rolled out that downtown event like 15 years ago.
That's right.
HPR's Noe Donegawa here. She's taking a closer look. First Friday, coming of age.
Mm-hmm, kind of. I mean, you know how it rocketed up, and after about the first 5 years, it really got traction. It was fantastic for a few years, and then it started kind of getting a little raunchy, and the art galleries kind of left the scene. It turned into more of a fashion daytime thing, and it was a big party drinking crowd at night, and the whole thing was just kind of spinning out a little bit, you know? But lately, organizations in Chinatown, different businesses, Hawaii Theater, all these different groups, Mark's Garage, Kumukohu, they're pulling together and really trying to recreate a beautiful scene downtown. And they got a terrific thing going now. I really think it's something worth talking about and going to. First thing people ask, right, Catherine, where am I going to park?
Yes.
So let me get you started by going to HISAM. You know, HISAM, the Hawaii State Art Museum, is the museum in the old Hameter building right across the state capitol, and you can valet park. You pull up there on Richard Street and valet park your car if you want, okay? You can do that, or I just found a parking space right on Richard Street this past Friday. It was great. And as I was heading into HISAM, You can notice that there's a beautiful lawn, and you kind of have to enter from the side. You go on in there, and there was a great, reception right in the area. The Super Groupers were playing, and that's Scott Otoro, Naveed Najafi, Illicit, one of the greatest hip-hop groups in this state. They were holding court there in the lobby, and it was just a fantastic. This is how you get your evening started there.
Cool.
At HISAM. In the HISAM shop, there was new work by Linda Hess, a kind of selfie station that she made with some wacky red and white poppies. And then there's a set of beautiful prints by Masami Teraoka. I don't know if you can picture his kind of semi-traditional Japanese woodblock print-looking things. This print is an oyster diver, a woman with indigo tattoos all over her body, and she's kind of crouched on a rock with waves breaking behind her. It's a very impactful print he's got there. And the HISAM shop also has a display of work by Lori Uehara, some thoughtful carved wood. They're kind of like three-dimensional fairy tales, Catherine. Like there'll be a little rabbit, and then there'll be a ladder, and then maybe a hand crank and an alarm clock or something. You look at it and go, hey, you just make up your own stories for these. They're beautifully made, too. And there are also some new martini glasses by Mark Mitsuda that are pretty nice. But, so there are people all wandering around there by the shop, and in that lower downstairs area, there's the cafe where they also sell drinks and so on. And Ali Ishikuni and Travis Sasaki of Mori by Art and Flea, they had their crew there. And that kind of means Roger Bong of Aloha Got Soul. He also has a little radio station called Central Pacific Time. And recently they released a new album by Nick Kurosawa. He was there that night, singing this sort of soulful version of himself. great to hear him. He debuted this sound at the Atherton, by the way, about a month ago. Hmm. Upstairs, you know, you go on up the stairway, and there's a new exhibit out there. It's called Men. I mean, you know how women have always been the subject of
right.
Michelangelo. Yeah. And it's been nice. Uh-huh. But this is all local artists on the subject of men. So there are portraits, there are full-body things, and it's really great to see couples, you know, like out on a date night, young couples just hanging out in front of these works and just looking at them, just talking about them. What is this thing trying to say to me? And there's also a show of new acquisitions up there as well. New acquisitions by the State Museum means that those are our new artworks, and they're worth going up to see. You know, I saw Jonathan Korth in that new exhibitions show. He's the president of the Honolulu Chamber Music Series, and it was so great to see him there because chamber music this season is fantastic. I've rarely seen a better one, so check out Honolulu Chamber Music. Also in that upstairs, the central part is kind of a glass-enclosed atrium. They have classical music up there, and there was an opera singer singing this very same night. So then you can descend the beautiful stairs and you're back out into the night, and that's the HISAM experience. From there, you head on over to, I'd say, get on over to Mark's Garage. Now, what I did was I took my car out and I just parked it right there in the lot on Barataria Street. Or you can park it in the lot right behind Long's, you know, there off of Pully. And I'm telling you, there is always space. Now, Mark's Garage is celebrating Pride Month this month with a show called Brown, Queer, and Also Here. Artworks and stories by LGBTQI, which is intersex, plus people. And, you know, there's a lot going on, a lot of people there with their artworks, their families. And on stage, if you have not been to a poetry slam lately, this is kind of how it sounds. So interesting. Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, let me tell you, people were getting on stage really digging down deep for this stuff. And it was a great crowd there, too. And there's LGBTQI programming all through the month, including a financial planning workshop and a showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Wow.
At the end of the month, right? Halloween.
It's kind of wild.
It's going to be hosted by Titta Titsling and her cast. There are a lot of nice paintings right across the street from Mark's Garage at Information. It's kind of a style shop. Adam Tomkison's got his work in there. And let me tell you, there's some nice stuff at sort of like breakthrough prices. And Barrio Vintage is right up Nu'uanu from Mark's Garage. A lot of people would not leave Chinatown without stopping by there. And, you know, on First Friday, there's just like the sidewalks are getting crowded with people again, too. People who are not falling down drunk. People who are looking at stuff and out for the first time. I met a lot of people who had never been to a First Friday before and were just checking it out.
I mean, it really sounds like just an incredibly eclectic mix of stuff, you know, from classic to kind of crazy.
Isn't that great to have in Honolulu?
It is.
I mean, there's the Hawaii Theater must be waking up because it's like a beast coming alive. That park that's there on the Makai side of it is looking much better, cleaned up. You know, Hawaii Theater kind of controls that whole block up to Nu'uanu. There's a new restaurant in where Epic used to be. It's Burmese, Rangoon, highly rated. And Solomon Enos has just opened a gallery. Just Makai of that, a new one. He's opened a gallery in front of his studio. And his studio was designed by Travis Sasaki from Mori by Art and Fleet. Fantastic. And it's they've arranged a beautiful display for these bronze polyfantastica figures that he's made over the years. It's really incredible. Upstairs is another studio for Tommy Height. His work is on display right now at the Aupuni Space in Kaka'ako. And, you know, they're closing down the street now between Nu'uanu and Smith. Hotel is closed. A lot of great places to eat and drink down there. There's another reason to check out First Fridays again.
So it's interesting. I mean, how long had it been before you took this visit?
Actually, just a couple of weeks, because I really, there have been some interesting things going on at HiSAM, so it's really good to keep an eye on. But now I see the rest of Chinatown's jumping on board, too.
All right, sounds like you had fun.
I did.
Come along next time.
Yes, I will.
All right, thanks so much. That was Noe Tanigawa taking a closer look at First Friday, Coming of Age.
Aloha, I'm Keikoa McClellan from the McClellan Group. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we explored the history of the Hawaiian Humane Society dating back to 1883. It was established and tasked with the mission of preventing cruelty to animals, and this is a goal that remains with it today. In 1887, Helen Kinau Wilder was the first person in the state to be commissioned by law enforcement to uphold animal cruelty laws. Appointed as a special constable by the Marshal of the Republic of Hawaii, Wilder would sit out on horseback to do many of the same tasks that are done by contemporary Hawaiian Humane Society officers in animal rescue trucks. Along with a dedication to preventing animal cruelty, the Hawaiian Humane Society also serves as an educational organization, an animal shelter, and a provider of wide-ranging community services and outreach programs. For today's backyard quiz, we asked you to tell us what year the group set up shop at its current location. The answer is that the Hawaiian Humane Society moved to Wailea Avenue in South King in 1942. We had no winners today. We stumped you 2 days in a row. For today's quiz, if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi.
Edith Piaf was just 4 feet and 10 inches tall, but the tiny French singer and actress left a huge mark in her home country and abroad. She died on this day more than 50 years ago. Her song, La Vie en Rose, is a French classic. And this summer, a Paris hula halau paid tribute to Piaf by sharing a hula at her gravesite in the historic cemetery Père Lachaise. Come along on the trip to the City of Lights. Ole and Mele, chants and songs. For months, members of Halau Mele and Halau Hula o Manoa rehearsed leading up to the 25th anniversary of the founding of a Paris halau. In a stuffy dance studio in the heart of Paris, they add polish for an upcoming hula performance. Ukulele and slacky guitar add the island touch to a now familiar French favorite.
Oh,
Miley Kaku lives in Paris now and teaches at the Halau. She recalled how years ago she choreographed a hula to the Edith Piaf classic as a way to bridge cultures. It has become, if you will, the Halau signature.
When Halau Hula o Manoa started, we were the first hula halau in Paris. And in order to give French people an idea of what the basis of hula is, which is really that the gestures correspond to the words in a song, a melee, I thought of creating a hula to a French song. And I tried to think of a song, and the song that came to me was La Vie en Rose by Edith Piaf, because it's a song that's very beloved here in France and all over the world. People know it, even in Hawaii. And it's actually, the words are very simple. So I choreographed a hula to it, and it's sort of become one of the hula of our halau. And since our festival this year is about commemorating our kupuna and our kumu, we thought it would be nice to come to the cemetery Père Lachaise and pay tribute to Edith Piaf by doing the hula, but also by presenting, because we have a Hawaiian version. I think it's a first in the entire world, a Hawaiian version of Edith Piaf's song, which is translated into Olelo Hawaii by Sam Gaughan. And we wanted also to present the Hawaiian and share the Hawaiian version with her.
Wherever you go, people, you turn heads because it's such a lovely song, and they know it in French, but then to hear it in Hawaiian is, I think, just something special.
Yes, it's very special, and it's a beautiful translation. Like all translations, it's not exactly, the words aren't exactly the same, but both versions just sort of give you that feeling. It's a sort of uplifting feeling. One of being a halau here in Paris, one of the things that we try to do is try to make that connection between Hawaii and France, and find ways that connect our two cultures, even though we're halfway around the world from each other.
And like a midsummer's dream, native French speakers and members of the halau from Paris and Hawaii pay tribute with a graveside hula for Edith Piaf, Paris's little sparrow. This was Simple and Sweet in French and Hawaiian for an audience of one. Aloha and mahalo, Edith Piaf, ahui ho.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we explore the French connection to the Oahu Cemetery with historian Nanette Napoleon. The graveyard stories may surprise you. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.